Just what they want today on the world. I'm Carol Hills. Online and on TV, images from the attack in Manchester get played on a seemingly endless loop. And for some, that's a real problem.
This is exactly the kind of media coverage that these types of killers and acts of terrorism or other kinds of mass shootings like this are aiming for.
Plus, ISIS claims responsibility for the Manchester attack. The group's social media feeds have recently featured images of children allegedly killed by coalition strikes in Syria and Iraq.
What that imagery is used to do is help stimulate thinking about retribution.
And later, a preview of tomorrow's meeting between President Trump and Pope Francis. Those stories and more on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Cowardly and callous. Two words used today by British Prime Minister Theresa May to describe last night's terrorist attack in Manchester, England. 22 people were killed and dozens were injured by an explosion at the Manchester Arena. That's the venue where American pop star Ariana Grande had just finished a concert when the blast went off. Here's more from the Prime Minister.
We now know that a single terrorist detonated his improvised explosive device near one of the exits of the venue, deliberately choosing the time and place to cause maximum carnage and to kill and injure indiscriminately. All acts of terrorism are cowardly attacks on innocent people, but this attack stands out for its appalling, sickening cowardice, deliberately targeting innocent, defenseless children and young people who should have been enjoying one of the most memorable nights of their lives.
Police in Manchester say many of the victims were very young, including an 8-year-old girl who was among those killed. Other details are still emerging. This afternoon, police identified the suspected suicide bomber. He was a 22-year-old Manchester native named Salman Abidi. His family is reported to be from Libya originally. Greater Manchester Police Chief Ian Hopkins didn't comment on that today, but he was careful to include these words in his statement.
We understand that feelings are very raw right now and that people are bound to be looking for answers. However, more than ever, it is vital that our diverse communities that make Greater Manchester such a strong place actually stand together and support each other. We will therefore not tolerate hate towards any parts of our community, and should communities be suffering from hate incidents or crime, then I would please urge them to report it to us.
As British police continue their investigation, ISIS has already claimed responsibility for last night's attack in Manchester. In an online message, the so-called Islamic State said one of its soldiers carried out the bombing. But the claim was not made public until 12 hours after the attack. So we asked independent terrorism analyst Michael S. Smith if he thought the claim was credible.
Yes, absolutely. And I would not call this a slow production or distribution of the claim itself. What was interesting is that the official statement was distributed by Islamic State propagandists prior to the report by the group's Amaq agency, which is basically headline news a la Islamic State, and is typically used to issue the initial claim of responsibility for this type of attack.
Why are you so certain that ISIS is behind it?
Islamic State is very careful about managing perceptions of the group, and the last thing that it needs is to claim responsibility for an attack and then a video be posted online by the person responsible in which he attributes the attack to Al-Qaeda. There's a very strong competition for dominance in the wider global jihad movement underway between Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. So it's really important for the group to effectively manage perceptions of it as a legitimate and credible enterprise that's worthy of support.
What kind of chatter are you seeing on jihadi social media sites?
Obviously, there's a tremendous amount of celebratory posting concerning this event. Islamic State has been calling for attacks in the West just like this since the fall of 2014. And the UK has been, listed as a priority target for those types of attacks that they want supporters to go out and execute. And you've seen an increased emphasis in calls for attacks in the West versus attempts to travel into the so-called caliphate. So this is very important for the group in that it helps to build further credentials that can be used to generate more support, especially within the ranks of groups like Al-Qaeda, where it's been calling for defections and for members of groups that aren't aligned with it to defect and join its ranks.
How does targeting a concert full of preteens and killing children help them achieve that goal?
During the past year, you've seen a notable increase in incorporation of images of children killed in strikes targeting Islamic State in Iraq and Syria especially. And so what that imagery is used to do is help stimulate thinking about retribution that can be useful to the group. And it also, within the so-called caliphate, can be used to help build and reinforce support in that this showcases the group is able to avenge the deaths of children who have been killed in coalition strikes and Russian strikes targeting its positions in various places in the Middle East.
Michael, is there any truth to the statement that there's been an increase in the number of civilian casualties from foreign airstrikes this year, in Syria in particular, and that this is being used by ISIS and other jihadi groups in their propaganda?
Yes, absolutely. And you do see a very strong emphasis during the past 6 months on documenting deaths of civilians, and especially children. That goes a long way to stimulating a will to act among people here in the West.
It's really hard to get my head around that one. Killing children is going to activate jihadis. People on the fence.
Yeah, I mean, it in their strategic logic, they want to avenge the deaths of all Muslims.
My last question is, could the attack in Manchester, going back to Manchester, is there any sign that launching such a disgusting attack and killing people is a sign that ISIS is on its heels in the areas where it's trying to get territory? And so they're putting their energy into overseas because that's kind of the only thing they can do.
I would advise against that line of analysis. According to the group's strategic logic, as highlighted in the fall of 2014, the group said that you can tell which group is most practicing of the faith by way of the orientation of counterterrorism resources from Western powers. And they went on to say a majority of those resources are being oriented against the Islamic State, not other groups. So In the views of jihadis, this factors into credibility, legitimacy, worthiness of support. And furthermore, what you're seeing with this increased instances of attacks in the West, that further highlights competency with their outreach. So what you see here is this is a very powerful credential that's actually used to help build and reinforce support within its primary areas of operations.
It's pretty depressing. Terrorism analyst Michael S. Smith, thanks so much.
Thank you, Carol.
To me, it feels a little bit like the killers were in a shadow producer seat.
That's author and social media analyst Zeynep Tufekci. She sees a disturbing pattern in the aftermath of the Manchester attack, a pattern in which Western media often plays right into the extremists' hands.
I'm horrified by what's going on like anybody else. But what I've seen a lot is a few videos played on endless loop. There are videos of people panicking. I've seen videos of sobbing mothers, distraught parents. I mean, it's horrible, but having this kind of media coverage on loop, repeated again and again, not only does it not have a particular news value, it traumatizes the victims and re-traumatizes them. And unfortunately, this is exactly the kind of media coverage that these types of killers or other kinds of mass shootings like this are aiming for. And I feel like we're giving them the coverage they're aiming for on their own terms.
Are you seeing this on social media or on official and respected news sites?
This is interesting. It used to be that there was a lot of that on social media, too. And I have to say, I think people in social media are ahead of mass media on this question now. When such incidents happen, not only do I see a lot of calls not to share gory pictures or not to share the same few videos of people panicking, When mass media does this, you know, when they go and share such videos and repeat it endlessly, I see a lot of people asking them not to. And right now, because of my work, I study social media. I follow thousands of people on many platforms, and I've just sort of glancing at it. And almost across the political spectrum, there's a visceral understanding that the terrorists are doing this partly so that we will share the kind of pictures and videos that will just horrify us viscerally, and refraining from doing it. Whereas if you look at mass media and across the political spectrum, you know, you can go to BBC or you can go to Fox News or you can go to MSNBC or CNN, the same few videos are played again and again and again. Partly they need to fill the hours, and there isn't that much to say except cowardly, depraved murderers kill children. And television is a visual media, so they just keep playing the thing almost reflexively. And previous research shows that mass killings of this type are absolutely inspired, unfortunately, by the kind of media coverage the previous one gets. And this is not just a phenomenon for religious-inspired terrorism like ISIS, but it's also a phenomenon for school shootings. It's a phenomenon for white supremacist terrorism. If you give them the kind of infamy they crave, it inspires more distorted, mostly young men, to try to repeat it.
One could argue that you have to show what happened and show the impact of it.
I mean, of course.
You know, you can go down the rabbit hole with this, but how should organizations like the BBC or CNN or whatever be handling this, given that they need to be a 24-hour news service?
Well, I think there are many ways to handle this that recognize that it is indeed news and it should be covered, just not covered in the terms kind of almost dictated by the killers. One of the things is to focus on victims, but again, not hounding the victims, but letting them speak. Another thing is to focus on the analysis part of what's going on. And I mean, even though it's horrible, and it's kind of hard to say this, it's the kind of thing that we need to cover and then not let it dominate our news 24/7. You can also focus on victims of ISIS in other countries. I had been writing and tweeting about ISIS and talking about it long before it became such a big deal in the Western world, because it has a lot of victims in the Muslim world. You know, it had been killing many more people there. And you can bring in that element that it victimizes people around the world. So we can balance the need to know more with not needing to have the same video on loop.
President Donald Trump has called those behind the Manchester suicide bombing evil losers in life, saying, "I won't call them monsters because they would like that term." What do you think of that choice of words?
I actually don't disagree. President Trump has come to power understanding the power of attention and monopolizing attention very well. And I think his instincts in this case are correct in that these people are seeking a particular form of attention, especially from mass media, and a particular form of description of who they are. And denying them that, both the attention and the terms they seek, seems like a good idea to me.
Zeynep Tufekci's new book is called Twitter and Tear Gas, The Power and Fragility of Networked Protest. Thanks so much, Zeynep.
Thank you for inviting me.
Still ahead, we hear from our reporter aboard a migrant rescue ship currently on a mission in the Mediterranean. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. We began our program today with the latest from Manchester and the horrible aftermath of last night's terror attack there, and we'll have more on that later in the show. Right now, though, we're going to switch our focus for a few minutes to Yemen.
What we have seen in Manchester is happening almost every day in Yemen. And it has been like for 2 years and a couple of months.
That's Bushra Al-Duhayna. She's an aid worker in Yemen for CARE International. This week, she's in Washington, D.C., though, to draw attention to the brutal civil war in Yemen and the humanitarian crisis there. Just last week, a suicide bomber in the capital, Sana'a, killed 29 people and injured 70 more. Food has been used as a weapon of war in the country. A naval blockade has slowed imports and caused shortages. Groups like CARE try to help by delivering food. But now there's another serious problem, a cholera outbreak that sickened more than 30,000 people. Bushra Al-Duhayna says Yemen is in need of just about everything at the moment: medicine, food, water, fuel, and the cash to buy those necessities.
It's everything, because everything is collapsing down. Like, people don't have access to clean drinking water, and this is one of the main reasons for cholera outbreak. The second is, like, even if some commodities and foods is available in the market, they don't have the financial capacities to purchase the foods, because most of the income resources has been, like, destroyed, and employees, they don't get their salaries for 9 months.
Do you deliver aid to whomever needs it, regardless of political affiliation?
Absolutely. As long as he's a human being, he's in need.
You're trying to get the word out about Yemen. You're trying to compete against a lot of other news stories that people are paying attention to. How do you draw attention to Yemen and get the international community and people like our listeners to focus on it?
I would explain it in terms of, like, the generation that is living this situation, like children and women and men in Yemen. They're going through the day, they think about how to survive. I mean, for the basics, like the water, the food, the shelter, they don't have places. I mean, their houses has been destroyed or they have been displaced, and they had to look after their survival needs.
You're a Yemeni. Give us a sense of how your country has changed over your own lifetime.
It has significantly changed. Like, no safe place, no more safe place in Yemen to stay in. I mean, the conflict is reaching out every place in Yemen, every single village, every single place.
You described a sort of constant disruption for the population of Yemen. Has that happened to you, where you were somewhere you thought was safe and you had to move on?
Yes, it has happened to me personally. I had to move and run for my life when the conflict started, and then I moved to another place where, again, it was not safe, and I lost two family members.
Oh, dear. When are you going back to Yemen, and what will be the first thing you do?
I'm supposed to be back within a week or 10 days, and hopefully that things work out. And, I mean, I will continue working with CARE International to help the people and support them as much as we could. And I will try to give the hope to the people that we're trying to reach our voice out so people can help us.
Bushra, what do you imagine your first day back in Yemen will be like?
I would imagine it like seeing my family at the first place and seeing the people. And I can't wait to go back to Yemen. I want to tell the people what did I do here and how people think and how people feel about it.
You said you can't wait to get back to Yemen, and yet it's considered one of the world's worst humanitarian disasters. What is it about the country that makes you want to go back?
It's my home. It's my home. It's my family. It's my people. They're very kind people, and I'm so proud to be Yemeni, and I think it's one of the best countries that you would visit ever.
Bushra Al-Duhaina works for the aid organization CARE. She spoke with us from Washington, D.C. Thanks so much, Bushra.
Thanks a lot.
War and poverty have long been pushing people out of the Middle East and Africa and towards Europe. And this year is no different. We're following a Save the Children rescue ship that's currently on a mission in the Mediterranean Sea. The crew aboard the Vos Hestia has been patrolling the waters off North Africa, working to help save migrants' lives. The World's Richard Hall is aboard the rescue ship. Richard, where in the Mediterranean are you right now?
So we're currently about 20 miles from the Libyan coast. Now, this is what's called the search and rescue zone. This is where rescue ships like this one patrol, looking for boats in distress.
Now, walk us through the latest rescue, which I understand is still going on and maybe one of the biggest of the year for Save the Children. Tell us about it.
That's right. Well, it began at around 6 a.m. Everyone was asleep in their bunks, and we were awoken by the captain, who told us that we were about 10 minutes away from a boat that was in distress. Now, that rescue took around an hour or so. There were around 74 people on board. And then there was a kind of a lull. Normally, when the boats are launched, they come in groups. They launch them all at the same time. So you should see more than one boat at the same time. So we're wondering why there was just one boat on its own. And then the captain spotted another boat nearby. And you can hear the moment that came through on the radio.
All stations, all stations, all stations. We received information about possibly 10 boats currently within Libyan territorial waters. We are proceeding to the position. ETA is about 1 hour from now.
That's a lot of boats, 10 boats. What does the crew do next?
So what happens is there are two lifeboats attached to this big ship, and you get a couple of rescuers go out on lifeboat with a cultural mediator, and that's someone basically with a megaphone, who speaks lots of languages, who can talk to the people on these boats that are in trouble. They can calm them, tell them that everything's going to be okay, and explain to them what's going to happen. And then what they do is they transfer them a dozen at a time onto these lifeboats and bring them back onto the ship here. And they're brought on and they're given blankets. They're told they're going to be rescued and taken back to Italy. And then they're given a quiet place to sit down and wait for other people to come on board. And during that time also, there's staff on hand to help people with anything. There are nurses on board. And they generally just kind of have to sit tight on deck until we get back to port. And I think we're around 2 days away from Italy.
So how many people has Save the Children brought on board today?
So the biggest rescue of the year for Save the Children was around 550 people. The rescue is still going on right now as I talk. We had around 450 last time I checked, and we were going out to rescue another boat. So this rescue could equal the biggest one of the year. And we're not the only boat out here as well. There's also a Médecins Sans Frontières boat. So by the end of the day, it looks like there could be around 1,000 people rescued from the ocean today.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it really is. It really is a large number. When you think, if these ships weren't here, I mean, more than 1,300 people have drowned so far this year trying to make this voyage. It really is a dangerous route. It's the most dangerous sea route to get to Europe. The smugglers in Libya are taking more and more risks with the people they're sending over. They want to make more money, so they're packing these boats full of people. Some of the boats we saw today were just filled to the brim with people. They were sat on the edge of the boats, basically falling out of the thing. And so, yeah, it's just a very dangerous journey.
Did the rescues today go smoothly, or did anyone drown? It's just awful to even ask that.
There was a tense moment when around a dozen people were in the water, but luckily they had their life jackets on. The drownings and the people dying tend to happen when there's no rescue ships around. And what happens generally is that these boats that these migrants are put on, they're just not seaworthy. They either come apart at the seams with the rubber ones, or they spring leaks. Sometimes the waves are just too high and they capsize the boats and people just fall into the water. Luckily today there were two big rescue ships here and they were badly needed because there were so many boats.
The World's Richard Hall is aboard the Save the Children rescue ship. He's off the coast of Libya in the Mediterranean. I'm Carol Hills. Children are among the victims of yesterday's terror attack in Britain. But should we try to protect our kids from the news?
I'd like my children to be aware of what's happening and to have an answer ready and to be proactive in their approach rather than be caught unawares.
Talking to kids about terrorism ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. For more than 20 years, a Christian militia group known as the Lord's Resistance Army terrorized Uganda. The LRA's leader, Joseph Kony, claimed to have magical powers. His aim was to take over the northern part of Uganda. And to do that, he depended mostly on child soldiers. An estimated 30,000 children were taken from their homes and forced to live in the wilderness and to fight. That includes thousands of young girls who were abducted, trafficked, and forced into sexual slavery. Today, the Ugandan government says the LRA is no longer a threat, and the hunt for Joseph Kony was officially called off recently. But the problem he and his group created is far from over. For our series this week on human trafficking, our Across Women's Lives project focused on what happens to all those boys and girls who are missing for decades and then come back from the wild. The World's Jasmine Garst has the story.
When he was 11 years old, a group of rebel soldiers came into Kenneth Banya's village. They told Kenneth that they were lost, and they asked if he could show them the way out of town. Kenneth's father told them, no, he can't give you directions. Because Kenneth's father knew exactly how this was going to end. The rebel soldiers insisted. They pointed and said, just walk us to that tree over there and tell us how to get out of town. And so Kenneth went with them. And when he got to that tree, they ordered him to keep walking. Kenneth never turned around. He was a child soldier now. One of the first things you might notice when you come to Uganda is the color of the earth, a deep ochre. In cities like Gulu, which is up north, the traffic whips up a reddish dust that covers everything. The motorcycles are mostly to blame. Hundreds of them swarm around. They're called bodabodas. And they're the closest thing to a taxi here. That's how I meet Kenneth.
Is this like rush hour traffic?
Yeah. Mm.
He's 43 now. He gives me a ride downtown and ends up talking about how, after they took him, those soldiers trained him to fight.
And Oilum a bit of training.
If you're surprised by how open Kenneth is with me about his story, you shouldn't be. There are so many people like him here. Many of the abducted children eventually came home, often to find their families had been killed, their villages wiped out. And all they knew how to do was survive in the wild. The Ugandan government scrambled to reintegrate them into society. But Uganda is a poor country. People like Kenneth were given 3 months of psychological counseling, a mattress, soap, and a change of clothing. And this was with the help of foreign aid groups. As the conflict wound down, so did the aid. Driving through town, we passed by a lot of places that used to be. This used to be a hospital for former abductees. That there used to be a rehabilitation center. This was once a school for children born in the bush. What remains are a handful of non-governmental organizations. And there's something else I learn. A collective disgust towards people like Kenneth. He says every day people call him a killer. They say he did bad things out there in the wild. And here's the problem. People are right. He remembers it vividly. Kenneth says this one time he looted a village. He and other LRA soldiers killed civilians. He says he wished he hadn't done it. And he wishes people understood he was a kid and he was terrified and hungry. And he was one of those fighters who was given a child bride out there. She was 8 years old. He was 13. He knows she didn't want to be there. You know what, he tells me? None of us did. So he says when people say he's a bad man, he just tells them that maybe they're right. I am a dangerous man, so leave me alone. But Kenneth isn't alone. He has a wife and a family. He wishes the government would still assist him, but what they gave him was enough to get him back on his feet. And he has his friends, the other taxi drivers. A lot of them are former child soldiers. I say goodbye and watch Kenneth join his friends at a nearby taxi stand. And I realize this is the story as told by men. Men who were once scared boys and are now leathery and tired, with scars and bullets still buried deep in their flesh. Men who rest on their motorcycles in the shade, remembering the days in which they were taken away and forced to fight. But where did all the girls go? Of all the children who were taken from their homes by the LRA, many were girls. They were trafficked and forced to marry soldiers and lieutenants. What happened to them? I leave the city of Gulu and head to the countryside. I've been told there's a woman there who I should speak to. Rural Uganda is lush and green at this time of year. Under the shade of a massive jackfruit tree, I meet a woman named Pasca Aquero. Pasca was snatched in the middle of the night. She was 12, and she was given as a gift to none other than Joseph Kony, leader of the LRA, known for his ruthlessness, who claimed to have magical powers. Pasca says she was terrified. He raped her, and soon she was pregnant with a baby boy. She says the baby distressed her. She figured he didn't stand a chance out here in the middle of a war. And she also worried, what if he took after his father? So one day, when he was 2 years old, Pasca walked into a field. The baby was asleep. She laid him under the tall stalks. And she walked away. Would you like to meet him? She asks me. He's out there planting potatoes. That day, 15 years ago, Pasca eventually went back into the fields. Her child was still asleep. She picked him up in her arms and did the only thing she knew how to do. Keep going. She leads us through the waist-tall grass. Pasca is barefoot and wearing a raggedy blue shirt that reads, in washed-out letters, Association of Ex-LRA Abductees and Survivors. When she finally escaped the LRA, her son was 7. They went through that government reintegration process. They gave her the counseling, the blanket, the mattress, the soap. But here's what they couldn't give her back. A community. And this is a problem women face here. They are often shunned by other women, considered ineligible to remarry. They are prone to slide into poverty. Boys can come back and they can get an education. But when girls come back from the wild, they often do so with babies to raise and take care of. School is not an option. And those babies, the children of LRA fighters, are unwelcome reminders that not so long ago, in this paradise, something horrendous happened. We finally arrive at the field, where a wiry boy is working the land. They have a small plot. He and Pasca live off what they grow. He turns around, and I hold in a gasp. He's the spitting image of his father, Joseph Kony. Pasca watches him. He's a wonderful boy, she tells me. He loves me. I love him. He's the only person who helps me. Sometimes I look at him and I remember the time I almost left him in the field and I realize I would have made a mistake. Back then, she dreamt what all the children dragged into the wilderness in the night dreamt of, running away. But when she finally managed to leave, she found out that girls don't always get to come back home. For the world, Jasmine Garst, Gulu, Uganda.
Tomorrow, Jasmine tells us about one inspiring woman who helps formerly abducted girls learn skills and build community. Her weapons, a needle and some thread.
Stitching, one stitch at a time. It's like stitching your life, one stitch at a time.
That's coming up tomorrow, right here on The World. President Trump left the Middle East today and headed for the Italian capital, Rome. And tomorrow he'll be at the Vatican to meet with Pope Francis. It's fair to say these are two very different world leaders in both style and substance. But as The World's Matthew Bell reports, there could be more common ground between the Pope and the president than meets the eye.
Trump and Francis have a past. The low point came during the campaign last year when the leader of the Catholic Church told reporters that someone who wants to build walls instead of bridges is not really a Christian. Trump dismissed those comments as disgraceful and called the Pope a very political person. Immigration, refugees, climate change, these are areas where Trump and Francis do not see eye to eye. Catholic bishops here in the United States have pushed back against the Trump administration's travel ban, along with policies that they see as anti-immigrant. Still, both men seem eager to avoid escalating their disagreements, and they are going out of their way to meet in person. Inés San Martín is the Vatican correspondent for Crux, a website that reports on the Catholic Church.
We live in a world in which we're based by what we see on television, what we hear on the radio and what we, you know, read in our social media feeds. But nothing replaces the importance of meeting someone face-to-face, of actually having that encounter. And Pope Francis is very big on this. He keeps talking about the culture of encounter, of meeting the other and also meeting the other where the other stands, not just claim you want to encounter the other, but actually going out of your way to do so.
This will be a short meeting, first thing on Wednesday morning, before the Pope holds his weekly public audience in St. Peter's Square. When they actually meet, it will be behind closed doors, so the public will only learn about it from statements after the fact. One thing that they might talk about, according to San Martin, is the plight of Christians in the Middle East.
President Trump has expressed concern for them, has vowed to try to tend to them, and Pope Francis, of course, sees these as a priority. Then another issue is religious freedom in foreign countries. That is another topic in which Trump has promised to work on, and this is something Pope Francis is particularly interested in.
And that includes religious freedom in the U.S. Trump says he supports the Little Sisters of the Poor, for example, a Catholic group that opposes the contraception mandate in the Affordable Care Act. Megan Clark teaches moral theology at St. John's University in New York. She says the issue of human trafficking is another problem that Trump and Francis have both expressed concerns about.
I think it's a place where there could be common ground sufficient to move a conversation forward in some important ways. And that's ultimately what Pope Francis is always interested in when it comes to these kinds of conversations. He's interested in dialogue.
At one time, it would have been difficult to see a meeting like this even taking place. And that's a victory of sorts, says Massimo Fagioli of Villanova University. He says the public tension between Trump and Francis had been threatening the relationship between two important world powers.
The United States is the hard power, the power of the military and of the economy. And then there's the soft power of the Vatican and of religion in general. And if you think that religion has something to do in some way with what's going on in the world of today, well, I think that those in power, they should talk.
After their closed-door meeting takes place, President Trump and Pope Francis are sure to be asked about it by reporters. In the meantime, there could be another way to find out how their talk went. Both leaders are quite prolific on Twitter. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
President Trump may be getting some relief as he travels around the globe this week from all those controversies that were swirling around him back in Washington, like the ongoing investigations into alleged ties between his campaign and Russia. But those investigations are still generating news. And today, a key former official gave some much-anticipated testimony on Capitol Hill. I'm talking about John Brennan, the man who led the CIA until this past January when Trump took office. Here's a quick recap of what he told the House Intelligence Committee today about Russia's meddling in the U.S. election last year.
It became clear to me last summer that Russia was engaged in a very aggressive and wide-ranging effort to interfere in one of the key pillars of our democracy. It should be clear to everyone that Russia brazenly interfered in our 2016 presidential election process, and that they undertook these activities despite our strong protests and explicit warning that they not do so.
Specifically, Brennan said he personally spoke to the head of Russia's Internal Security and Intelligence Service, the FSB. Brennan warned him that meddling in the U.S. election would backfire and damage the U.S.-Russian relationship. And as to whether the Trump campaign acted in collusion with the Russians, Brennan told the committee he was worried enough to convey his concerns to the FBI.
I encountered and am aware of information and intelligence that revealed contacts and interactions between Russian officials and U.S. persons involved in the Trump campaign that I was concerned about because of known Russian efforts to suborn such individuals. And it raised questions in my mind, again, whether or not the Russians were able to gain the cooperation of those individuals. I don't know whether or not such collusion, that's your term, such collusion existed. I don't know. But I know that there was a sufficient basis of information and intelligence that required further investigation by the Bureau to determine whether or not U.S. persons were actively conspiring, colluding with Russian officials.
Former CIA Chief John Brennan speaking today to members of the House Intelligence Committee in Washington. Last night's terrorist attack at an Ariana Grande concert in Manchester has been dubbed an attack on many things, including freedom of expression. Pakistani-American writer Rafia Zakaria says it was also an attack on culture.
The attack on culture, the attack on music and art is it's very strategically savvy because those are the means by which we engage in this very basic human desire to express ourselves and to enjoy ourselves.
Zakaria says that taking away people's ability to enjoy themselves, to have fun, that is an attack on culture. She fears that such attacks will deter audiences from engaging in cultural events in the future or even lead to bans for safety reasons. She says it's already happened in other parts of the world where terrorist attacks are much more frequent.
You know, it seems like a slow or perhaps not so slow encroachment. I mean, you know, from Pakistan to Afghanistan to the Middle East, on an onslaught and all stuck. No concerts, no literary festivals, no fun, no laughter, no coming out in cafes. And now it's reached the Western world. And so there is, I see this with immense amounts of heartbreak.
But beyond instilling fear, Zakaria says the ultimate goal of this attack is to pit the Western world against the Muslim world. She says ISIS and similar groups are sending a very calculated message.
I think that the audience for this is the Muslim world, and the frame in which they are trying to present it is, look at these Westerners. They're so sort of immersed in revelry and kind of a hedonistic fun And then we are coming into the middle of that and avenging their sort of lack of empathy for the rest of the world. Now, it's a very distorted argument. I don't think it's an argument that, you know, the majority of the Muslim world believes in or sympathizes with, because they want to have fun too. And they realize that, you know, terrorist groups like ISIS are responsible for much of the carnage. But I'm trying to show or trying to emphasize the sort of intended optics for this beyond the Western public.
And the response to these terrorist incidents can deepen the divide and lead to what she calls a perverse sense of competitive victimhood.
You know, people in the Muslim world look at something like this and say, well, we've lost hundreds of people and thousands of people. So, you know, everybody is sort of entrenched on their side and everybody is hurting. But the problem, of course, is that, you know, we're not able to cross those borders and empathize with each other, which is, of course, exactly what ISIS wants.
Rafia Zakaria is a Pakistani-American writer. Her work appears in Al Jazeera English and other publications. The aftermath of an attack like the one at the Ariana Grande concert in Manchester last night has become almost familiar. The grieving for the victims, the search for the suspect, the piecing together of a motive, and the slow recovery of the community. But last night's attack was a little different. Most of those hurt and killed were children and teenagers. They're out to have a good time at a concert of a famous pop star. So how do you talk to kids about this? Joining us now is Nazish Yarkhan, a writer and communication strategist based in Chicago. Nazish, how much do you strike a balance between telling kids the reality of an attack like this and scaring them?
You know, I think in this day and age, because everything is online or it's on TV, you're doing children a disservice if you're not really laying the facts out as they are, because they're going to hear about it from somewhere and someone, if not you. So the idea that we're going to try and cover up or soften the blow is just not going to happen, because they're going to get the information from somewhere or the other. And I'd like my children to be aware of what's happening and to have an answer ready and to be proactive in their approach rather than be caught unawares. Even when I had children who were in primary and elementary school, we had conversations that were very, very difficult but were very necessary.
Do you assume they're looking at the online videos of the panicked concert goers? And do you assume they're watching them, or do you sort of try to actually show it to them and talk them through it?
I wouldn't show them. You know, the imagination is wild enough as it is, and kids don't need to see that. It's unnecessary. It frightens them even more than they need to be frightened. And you're going to tell them, you know, you don't need to watch that. What's the purpose behind it? You know, a lot of children died. But it's heart-wrenching. It's heart-wrenching to think of those parents who are, it's just heart-wrenching.
I want to play what President Trump had to say about the attack.
So many young, beautiful, innocent people living and enjoying their lives murdered by evil losers in life. I won't call them monsters, because they would like that term. They would think that's a great name. I will call them from now on losers, because that's what they are. They're losers.
I'm wondering if Trump using a word like loser actually helps kids understand this a little better.
I actually might think so, you know, although we always say that Trump's vocabulary is rather limited. But in this case, just because the audience is younger kids, I think that would actually work. And I would never find myself saying that I agree with Trump on most anything that he says.
Your own son was 11 at the time of the Boston Marathon bombings. He's now 15. What advice can you give for talking with kids at different ages when this occurs?
I think when they're little, the idea is to reassure them that tomorrow is not going to be the same around your school, but you need to be careful for sure, you know. And as they're older, they don't talk about these things as much as when they were younger. And I think my job as a parent is to be able to broach that topic more than once. And yes, he says, of course, I know everything, because now he's 15, he knows everything. But I think as a parent, it's our job to reassure them that we live in safe times for the majority of our existence, you know, especially in the United States. But that's not to say that we don't hurt for those who are caught in situations like this. And you have to be vigilant, but you can't become paranoid. You can't be watching over your shoulder every single time.
What would you recommend to a parent who has like a 5 or 6 year old? What's the right way to talk to a young child about this?
That's really, really is hard when they're that little. But again, like I said, because they're hearing so much and they're watching it on TV. So our whole idea that mama's here for you and we're going to take care of you and we're going to love you no matter what and we're going to watch out for you. And a lot of the apps we have on our phones now, you know, we know where our kids are. And I think that gives us such a sense of security. And to think that 10 years ago, we didn't even have that. So just to be able to tell your child that mama knows where you are and we can come and get you if we ever need to. I think that's really, really important for smaller children, especially.
What about parents in this case? You know, some of the most heartbreaking scenes after this attack in Manchester were the parents waiting to be reunited with their kids. What can parents do to manage their own fears about sending their kids to big events like concerts?
My piece of advice is you still have to do what you have to do. You can't stop living because then when you're given to fear, that's when the other side has won. You be vigilant, but you don't stop living.
That's Nazish Yarkhan, a writer and communications strategist in Chicago. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Carol.
And that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.